I tend, I think, to be, I don't know if it matters to you, I tend to be a bit sibilant, and my, I don't know if my peas pop, but I'm sort of sibilant, as you can hear.
Me too.
Oh, okay.
This is the kind of interview that I could do just with a notepad, actually, but what I do, I take bits and pieces, and I integrate it, so it doesn't really matter. All of the dumb questions and inarticulate phrasing of mine, I take out, and so I make myself look very good. No, I... Anything that,
can I come back to make myself look good?
Well, the broadcast is very short, so obviously I have to take out pauses and gaps and things. It sounds good.
Authorial stutters.
I'm very pleased with it. Well, I loved your book.
Oh, thank you.
A marvelous book, and I laughed and laughed and.
Oh, great!
After I had read it, I called Random House and I said, I really want to talk to her. Does she speak?
She grunts, yes.
And she did. So it's marvelous. Before I ask you a couple of questions about the book, I want to find out a little bit about yourself and where you're from and all that.
Well, I was born in New York, and I grew up in Miami Beach, Florida. And then as soon as I could, I came back to New York.
What did your parents do?
My parents, my dad's a lawyer, and my mother is a housewife who has done a good deal of organization work and what we call her the supervisor, supervising various projects, taking her energies and turning them outward into the community because she didn't at that time have a career. She also did substitute teaching. I think she's a woman who would have probably benefited from having a career with so much energy. But at the time that she and my father were setting up their marriage, it wasn't that much done, I don't think. Mm. And so she's got a great deal of energy, and she puts it in good places.
When did you leave New York to go to Miami Beach?
Oh.
Miami. What was it, Miami Beach or Miami?
Miami Beach. Uh-huh. It was still a swampland. No, it was... I was a kid. I don't know. I was one or two. If I had known, I would have protested. And I would have tried to stay in New York.
Well, you're really kind of a Floridian then, really, huh?
That's where you were
reared. Where did you go to school?
I went to school, public high school, but I went to a yeshiva the first 9 years of school, which is half a day Hebrew studies, half a day English studies. Mm-hmm. And it was quite wonderful in ways because all the old Hebrew law books... concentrate on, there are no vowels in Hebrew. There are only, I believe they're called diacritical marks that go under the consonants. And if a mark is missing, and often there are no marks, a word may mean something else. So there was much in the Middle Ages, there were many schools of rabbis arguing the one with the other as to what was the meaning of a word or this and that. It was wonderful for somebody who wanted to be a writer to hear people saying that so much depended on a dot or a little line. And that was good. What was bad about it was that it was very insulated. And I came out of this grade school, basically, to go to public high school, and I found out that the Greeks and the Romans had existed as wonderful cultures unto themselves. They hadn't been solely bent on destroying the synagogue. I had been taught a very orthodox, fundamentalist view of religion. And it was a view I respect, but to my way of thinking had some narrowness to it about what other cultures were doing. So that part of it I was angry about for a few years.
But Judaism was surrounded by pirates.
In that way that the Greeks, that the only thing the Greeks had in mind at that time was to in some way interfere with religion when that's not quite so. Historically, or the enrichment of both Hellenism and Judaism of each other, and the historical trade between the two, the mutual enrichment, none of that was discussed. So I wandered into public high school, and I was astonished when I had a world history course. The teacher also had a water pistol in the course, I remember. I was also astonished at that because I was used to very... formal teachers.
Did the teacher use the water
pistol? Yes. Flat. You don't know the answer. You know.
I think that's against the law, isn't it?
Well, they were paddling kids back then, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not so bad.
No. As long as you're not the one being paddled.
Where did you go to college?
Sarah Lawrence, mm-hmm. Up here in Bronxville for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Just 2 years?
Yes.
Just 2 years?
Yes.
You ever plan to go back and finish up the degree?
Sometimes I thought of it, but I... I've always liked to do what I like to do, rather than what someone would have me study or do.
Are you saying you're self-indulgent?
Yes, to a degree. I'm not a very good student in subjects I don't like. And I think I wasn't mature enough to take advantage of what Sarah Lawrence had to offer in one way, which was a great deal of independence in study. I wasn't mature enough for that. On the other hand, I resented the fact very deeply that they were urging everyone to be creative. And I was 17 years old, and I didn't know anything at all. And I wanted to know something, and I had nothing to be creative about. I wanted to know some facts. I wanted to know more about history or literature or something that would feed me, and instead I was being told to be creative, and I resented that because I didn't have anything to be creative about.
What brought you to New York, or actually back to New York?
I decided to just go and live in New York and leave school and be in New York, and that's
how
what
do you
I did.
Do that? I mean, I remember when I was a young man out of college in the Midwest, and I wanted to go to New York so badly. I thought, gee, I could come here maybe as a dishwasher, just anything to get to New York. But I never had the courage to do that.
I got a job not far from here. In fact, as I was coming here, I passed the building where my first job in New York, and I will not name the company, but it was a large company, a cosmetics company, and I was one of several young women who under the same name answered letters that people wrote in. Why is my hair turning green using this product? May I have free samples? We would all answer these letters. That was the first job I had in New York.
Kind of like Betty Crockett.
Something like
or
that.
Crocker, is yes. it Crockett?
Crocker,
I guess.
Yes.
Is it Betty Crocker?
Yes.
Everybody thinks that she's a real person?
Yes,
Aunt
exactly.
Jemima actually makes the baking powder?
Yes.
It doesn't happen at all. When did you come back to New York?
It was after my second year at school. I'm trying to think when that was. I guess it was 65.
Mm-hmm. And you've been back ever since?
Yes.
You live in the village?
Yes, I live in the village.
Have you always lived in the village?
Yes, except for the first half year I lived up in the 90s. I lived up on 92nd Street in an apartment that was a basement, you know, from the old My Sister Eileen type thing. I could see the people's feet walking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the first week I was there, a man came and knocked on the door. And I was, you know, you're not supposed to let men in, not a strange man. I was very aware of all of this. And he kept insisting he was a policeman. And I made him show all his badges and everything. Finally, he opened the door and said, "Lady, there's a peeping Tom who's been pushing your window shade aside for, you know, all evening. And you're going to have to fasten the shade to one side," because the man was bending down on the sidewalk and pushing the shade in. And that was my first taste of New York. So I taped my window shade to the wall.
Didn't stay in that apartment too long, yeah?
Not too long, no. And this enormous water bug wandered in, and I couldn't kill it with a whole New York Times.
They're not water bugs, you know.
What are they?
They're roaches.
I was trying not to think of it that way.
Water bugs are kind of a sanitized description of roaches.
Well, I heard these were these Ceylonese armored creatures that came on the boats in World War II or something like that. And just you dance on them, and they don't die. You know, they click. But they don't die. There's a skeletal structure to them or something, an external one. Anyway, I left that apartment soon afterwards.
I don't blame you. During this period, you were working at the cosmetic firm, and you're obviously not working there now.
No.
And how long did you work at the cosmetic firm?
Oh, I guess about a year, maybe 6 months.
Then what happened?
I'm not sure. Then I just embarked on a series of very odd jobs, copy editing, proofreading, reading educational tapes that people made that would be distributed in schools, mathematics tapes, art history tapes, how to use, I don't remember what the word was, it was something like touche, T-U-S-C-H-E, I think some kind of art term, I don't know, and I just remember this 20 minutes of five people sitting around trying to discuss fan your touche or something like that and laughing very hard, doing stuff like that for several years while I tried to figure out how I could do what I wanted to do.
Are you currently employed?
I work freelance
as a writer.
Yes.
Somewhere along the line, you became married.
Yes, and then somewhere along the line thereafter, I became unmarried.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you were in the yeshiva, you keep saying, subsidizing myself until I could find a way to do what I want to do. And obviously that's very important to you, to do what you want to do. Back in the yeshiva, did you have any inkling that you wanted to become a writer?
I did. In fact, there are certain little stories I remember that anger me. They're not nice. They're not certainly about a whole group of people, but they represent individuals that were painful stories. I remember I sat up all night writing a story in Hebrew. We had a lot of homework because we were doing 3 hours a day of the public school, all the public school studies, and 3 hours a day of Hebrew study. So it was a quite advanced curriculum, and there was a lot of homework to do each night. And I sat up all night writing a story in Hebrew for an assignment. A week later, the teacher, was a rabbi, in fact, said he was passing out the papers, and he said, "One person, however, has received a zero because she cheated, and she will know who she is." And I got my paper back, and there was a zero on it. And I went up and I asked him, I was in the sixth grade, what did I do wrong? And he said, "Well, you clearly cheated. Your parents wrote the story for you." And my parents don't know Hebrew. My parents sent me to the Hebrew school not because they're Orthodox Jews, but because I was born 16 days too late for public school, and they knew it was a good private school. And I remember that. I remember there were contests, there were essay contests that I lost because they said my parents helped me in that. So I wanted to write, and I liked writing, and I must have been doing okay at it if nobody believed I did it.
You must have been very precocious.
I was very angry, I remember. I was very rude to the teacher after it got cleared up a bit. He said to me, the one who'd given me the zero, I went home and complained, and there was a conference or whatever with him and he and my parents and the principal, and later my teacher told me fairly nonchalantly, "Well, that's all right, you can put an A on your paper." And I said quite disrespectfully, "It doesn't matter what's on my paper, are you going to put an A in your book?" You know, because I was that angry that he hadn't trusted me, he hadn't asked me, he had just assumed that I had cheated and I had spent the whole night working on it. It didn't seem a great reward for trying hard.
Well, you deserve to be angry. It was an outrageous act and a false assumption. He never even asked you or went to you to discuss it. I can understand why that would be hurtful. Isn't it strange that we look back at our young days and we remember the slights that especially people who are in authority give us, teachers who were nasty to us?
Oh, there are wonderful teachers, too, that I remember in the same school, and I treasure them. I think of all they taught me. And I never understand why in this country teachers aren't a very high-paid profession.
Was there any one teacher that you look back at who may have motivated you from a literary standpoint?
Yes, there were three or four teachers, actually, both at the yeshiva and in public high school, just communicating their love of English and their care. And when I got a little bit too proud of what I'd written, they explained to me very nicely why it was not as good as I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very gentle about that.
After leaving Sarah Lawrence, coming to New York, working for the pharmaceutical firm, moving uptown, moving downtown, did you start to write during this period?
I was always writing, but I was very shy about it. I thought that it was a rather hopeless idea because at that time I thought, well, to go back, I guess I have to go back briefly. When I was a little girl, I'd read the Miami Herald, which is quite different now. But at the time, I would read that so-and-so was a good woman writer. And then there would be Steinbeck or Faulkner, and they were writers. And at the same time, it would say, so-and-so is a great dancer, and so-and-so is a good black dancer. And I got this notion that there were categories and subcategories, and I wanted to be in the main category. And I despaired of it. I just thought, well, there are always writers and women writers, and being a writer is the thing to be. Even if you'd be the least of all the writers, it's still better than being the top of the women writers, if that's a subcategory. You know, I just wanted to be a writer. And so I thought that maybe that wasn't a reasonable thing to want to be. And I didn't have any strong push in the opposite direction. I think part of my predicament was preposterous. My thinking that.
Well, not really, because particularly in the past, women had trap themselves into writing about women's themes to a great degree, and not universal themes. And this still happens to a degree. And I think that this is changing now.
Well, to a degree, there is one other point I could make about that, about universal themes, which is that both men and women do have, to a degree at times, different preoccupations, sometimes merging, sometimes not. And that often when a woman writes badly, someone will say, oh, this is female writing, this is bad. When a man writes badly, we should say he's also exaggerating the worst in himself, and we'd say he's writing malely. You know, he's over macho, or he's emphasizing that part of himself, the male part.
Say he's writing junk.
Yes, and so women can write junk and men can write junk, but the preoccupations when they're human and when they pertain to the truth or the need of the man or the woman, it's good writing, usually. Emily Dickinson certainly is a genius. Some of her poems are not very good, and criticism has been that they're too female. Yeats is a brilliant, wonderful, wonderful poet. At times, some of his poems are less than marvelous, and that's when he's pursuing his male themes to the exclusion of his female self. He's not in balance either, nor is she at times. So I take a minor exception to what you just said, in that I don't think it's been the confinement to certain interests that's been the problem for women, but the lack of perception critically that when men are failing, they're failing in their work because they're doing parodies of being men, and when women fail in their work, they're doing parodies of being women, and neither is acceptable.
Were you writing prose or fiction during this during these fledgling years as a writer?
Lots of fiction.
Fiction?
Yes. There's a wonderful line from Dylan Thomas when he describes his early stabs at fiction, and he calls, he says something, I thought they were marvelous, like eggs laid by tigers. I always think that was a wonderful line. I tried tiger eggs a lot, but they were pretty strange.
Tell me about your first published story.
That was called In Case of Survival. It was in Esquire in 79, toward the end of 79, I believe. And it won two awards, which took me completely aback, and I thought, oh, that's my whole career. I have one story and that's it. It was about a man who believed that he'd had an ESP experience. He was a very polite, very gentle man walking on a plane with his rather talkative, rather aggressive wife. And he had an image of the plane crashing. And the image was so overpowering that he stopped, and his wife wanted to go on the plane. And the only way he knew how to stop her, because he couldn't possibly explain to her that he'd had a vision, was he knocked her out. And the story begins a few months later in his home at night when he's writing a letter to the survivors of the air crash, because the plane indeed did crash. And he's trying to explain why he couldn't save them, or write to the relatives and explain to them why he couldn't save the people who died in the crash. And that's the story. In fact, I just found out today that a sequel to that story just got bought and is going to be appearing, I think, in November in Gentleman's Quarterly.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Yeah, it's nice.
You were writing short stories. You embarked on the novel. Tell me how the novel developed in your mind. When did you start it?
I started it... I was in 79. I had to put it aside a few times to go and do other things to earn money. But I was interested in the kind of man who pursues anything that looks female, just on the notion that there's some salvation in what, if you can use in the radio, jumping her bones or whatever, you know, in someone seeking some peace. I don't mean that as a pun. I meant tranquility that way. Some respite from pressures of work, whatever. And I also had seen by then in my few years in New York, I had seen a lot of talented people wasting their talent. I had seen a lot of people with what you could call the artistic temperament, and no artistry, and people who had great artistry and no artistic temperament, and it seemed as though there were some combination of the two needed in order to get on with work. But the most fascinating and the most tragic to me were people who had a wonderful artistic temperament and really no artistry, no talent to back it up, because they were always smart enough to know that they lacked that essential to get them where they wanted to be, and that they were, in a way, doomed to be play actors at a play they didn't like, and that was all they had. And there was a kind of nobility in the way they went on with it.
Well, you made Howard Ritchie kind of a likable villain. I liked him a lot. I, of course, you couldn't admire his insatiable satirism, I suppose. But as an literary editor, I liked his style, his thinking, and the things that he went through looking for the perfect manuscript, like looking for a 10 in a way. And I was very amused by that. You realize, don't you, that if you had written this book and tried to sell it 25 years ago, you would have been arrested as a pornographer?
Would I?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a wonderful idea.
You realize before Barney Rossett over at Grove Press and is going to court over Lady Chatterley's Lover, we weren't supposed to write in the way that you have written, Elboy and the Seducer?
You mean I should be grateful for all that? I didn't really realize that.
A lot of people had to go to jail, and a lot of books had to be banned before we could write in a sexually explicit way.
I feel speechless. I don't know what to say. It doesn't seem to me that what I've written is pornographic. It seems to me essential.
It's not pornographic, but it's the kind of language and the kind of style that would have been deemed pornographic at one point in the 20th century. But it is also wonderful to see that that women are able to write as explicitly as men, indeed, in the things that matter to us all. We tend in the past to have hidden a lot of the things we've done and have coated them over, glossed over them. And you've written very explicitly. I think you have to admit that.
Oh, yes. Because to me that's one of the themes of the book, that how the different people in the book perceive or use sex. And certainly from everyday experience, all of us use it or approach it in different ways at different times for different reasons. And it's not just what it used to be in the movies that I used to see, where the couple kissed and then they pan off to a clock or the fire or something, or fountains going off, yeah, or something like that. So what is the giving mean if you don't know who you are and what you're giving? What does the withholding mean if you know what torture you're causing someone else? When is it love and when is it power?
What I liked about Elboy and the Seducer more than the sex, obviously, was the portrayal of the New York literary establishment, The who was the critic? I've forgotten his
Newman
name.
Newman Sykes.
He's going down to the bookstore with a shopping bag full of copies that will be remaindered. I mean, I see this all the time because I hang around the Strand bookstore a lot. And the characters had a nice ring to them, and so I was fascinated by them. Do you consider yourself an observer of the literary establishment? Or was this coincidental?
I like to go to bookstores myself. I certainly read a good deal of about things like this. I've certainly had my share of meeting other writers, etc. So I'm not too sure. This is I was observing what interested me for the purposes of this book. It wasn't the literary scene. It turned out to be that, it seemed. It was what interested me. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
Well, you seem to have a very good ear for it, or at least a very good eye for it, which you translated to the page, and I think that was what I was trying to get across. Whether or not you have been directly involved in it, for example, I don't think you've ever been directly involved in publishing, have you?
No. I did, as I said, I did freelance copy editing, but that's certainly quite a remove. So I've never really been involved. My one dim venture into anything remotely resembling publishing was I did at one point work for Ralph Ginsberg when he was running Avant Garde magazine, and that was wonderful. I was there for about 3 or 4 months. Yes. Right. Well, he gave me a very good lesson about that. I knew he was under indictment still, or his case was pending in the Supreme Court, and I'd been hired freelance to read the unsolicited manuscripts. And somebody had sent in on a letterhead the Tool and Die works of such and such a place. I don't know, these elongated phallic drawings. And I was concerned. I knew here is this man who was about to go to jail, and I believe it was for allegedly sending obscenity through the mail or something, you know, some kind of mail problem. And so M-A-I-L problem. So I brought him the drawings, and I said, is it okay to send these back? Because I wanted to return them, but I didn't want him to be in further trouble. And he looked at them, and he said sort of sadly, no, people only get upset if it's good stuff. This is bad. You can send it back.
How did the novel actually come about? Did you approach Random House, or how did it work?
Well, I had about 50 pages of it written. I gave it to my agent, Harriet Wasserman, and she gave it to John Galassi, who was then at Houghton Mifflin, and he said he wanted it. And then John later left Houghton Mifflin and went to Random House, and I went with him.
Did you work closely with him?
Yes, the book had two publishers before it ever got finished. But yes, I worked with John. He's quite wonderful to me.
So in the editing process, you did deal with the editor quite a bit. A lot of times an editor is an acquisition person and doesn't spend as much time on the book as, say, the old-fashioned editor in the mold of Maxwell Perkins.
Yes, I have definitely heard that's true, that there are many editors out there busily acquiring, and the language is deteriorating in the manuscripts, and they're acquiring more. I don't know how much that's true, but I was feeling lucky to work with John.
Well, it's unusual to a degree, because most, especially when you're dealing with a first novelist such as yourself, many of the editors, many of the publishing houses prefer to see the whole thing before they buy it. But obviously, you would charm them with your 50 pages. No comment on that. Let me ask you about, we're almost out of time, and we have to vacate the studio.
All right.
But you have signed your name T. Gertler. Are you going to, is it that you wish not to divulge your first name?
I like the look of T. Gertler better than I like my full name. My name is Trudy. Never seemed to me quite suitable for anything beyond 6 years of age. It's a diminutive. It's my full name. It's not a nickname.
But you would not object if I were to use Trudy on the radio.
Oh no, that's my name. But I signed my books or my writing T.
Well, El Boy and the Seducer was a wonderful book and a wonderful experience reading, and I certainly enjoy it. I think the last question I should ask you is, what can we expect from you in the future?
Well, I've started another book, and it's tentatively titled Heavy Breathing, though I'm not sure that's what it will be. And I would hope that it won't take me as long this time. I would like to do it in a year and a half or so, and come visit you again.
Well, I hope that you won't be interrupted by the need to make money as you were with El Boy and the Seducer.
Yes, I certainly hope so, myself.
You've had some very nice reviews for El Boy and the Seducer, haven't you?
Yes, I've been very, very lucky and very, very happy to see the attention it's gotten because of its being a first novel. I was surprised that did happen, and very glad.
Well, you've hit a lot of people where it hurts, too.
Oh, I didn't intend to do that.
It's all right. It's all right. It's a wonderful book, Trudy Gertler. And
there, you see, I have no objection to Trudy.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for talking to me, and I appreciate your coming in, and I'm certainly going to look forward to some heavy breathing from you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.